Behind the net for Marsh. Marsh clearing it around for McKechnie. He flips it out to center ice, and Gretzky has it. Gretzky down the left boards along with McKechnie. Gretzky controlling it. Inside the blue line. Gretzky getting set. He shoots. He scores! Just a one-man show, Wayne Gretzky.
Well, what a move. Here's a 16-year-old hockey player that's got the brains of a 30-year-old pro. He just made quite a move, held on to the puck. Here he comes over the line, maintains his balance, puts that stick on, comes in, pulls the puck to the side, and puts it over the Czechoslovakian goaltender.
Let's get it on the second.
He's dumped almost down, maintains his balance, gets his stick back in the ice, comes, holds, then the backhand up over the goaltender.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to I Left My Wallet. I'm Antonio the Promise Thomas, also known as Thomas Santel, and I want to thank you for tuning in today because we got Lance Storm. Now, Lance and I go way back to 2004 when I first got to OVW. He had just started there as a trainer in OVW the year he was there, and I've had many trainers over my life. I trained, it started at Killer Kowalski's, Dr. Tom Pritchard, trained in All Japan, Les Thatcher, numerous, Jeff Costa up here in New England, numerous trainers. Lance probably, for me, is my personal favorite just because of his temperament, the way he treated you as a worker, as a person in the ring. And that's not a knock on any other trainer. Les, Dr. Tom, Kowalski's fantastic. Some of the best trainers ever. But for me, Lance was awesome. And I think if you talk to anyone in that time that was in OVW, Dolph Ziggler, Bobby Lashley, Mickey James, they'll all echo those same sentiments. And usually you'll hear Lance on Figure Four Daily on Fridays, but we got him here today. We're not really talking current wrestling. We're not doing a Q&A, but what we're doing is talking about some things you usually don't hear Lance talk about, and that's his athletic background. How did he get that great vertical leap? All that athleticism. He talks about it. Talks about playing volleyball, basketball. Yes, Lance played basketball, if you could picture that. And then we get into some health and nutrition, working out, fitness, what made Lance Storm the maybe the best drug-free physique easily in wrestling at the time and maybe of the last 40 years. Fantastic physique, what he did then for nutrition and training, what he does now. And then we're going to finish off with some wrestling. We talk about what he did at OVW when I first got there, how he came up kind of with the curriculum. And we talk about just some things going on today with training and what he sees in some of the matches he watches and the matches he critiques for his virtual lessons. I want you to go to the board, find the Lance Storm thread here on the site, and I want you to leave a comment. Let me know what you like. Let me know guests you want to hear. Give me some feedback here on the board. The Left My Wallet Lance Storm thread. You can also follow me on Twitter. Leave a comment at Promise Thomas or at Retro Grappler for my Thomas Santel persona. But I want to know what you think. This was a fun conversation. We go for an hour. Lance was great. I always got along with Lance. It was great catching up with him before and after what you hear on this show. We were probably chit-chatting for a good 90 minutes or so, and it was great to catch up. And I hope you enjoy this. This is a different side of Lance Storm, but one that I know you're really going to enjoy. Here he is.
I
I never heard you talk much about hockey, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, you said you weren't a diehard hockey fan or played much hockey growing up. And I want to know, growing up in Canada, how does a young boy not get immersed in hockey?
Yeah, because not a hockey fan would be even generous. Never liked it, never followed it. I'm not even 100% sure. I probably have. I'm not even 100% sure I've ever had skates on and a hockey stick in my hand.
Wow.
Like, I would have played street hockey at times as a kid, for sure. And I skated at a time, for sure, as a kid. But I'm not 100% sure I ever put those two skills together.
And in Canada, you know, babies learn to skate, I think, before they can walk, correct?
I don't know about before, but certainly shortly thereafter.
Yeah, yeah. Or
and
yeah.
I always despised cold weather.
Okay.
But I also, and this is sort of, I always contributed my agility and my speed and so forth to this. It's like, I've got tiny feet and tiny ankles. And skating just seemed to be something that my ankles did not have the strength to do. And like, I skated, like, you know, I had skates as a kid all the time. And we used to, I don't remember what day, but, you know, in the winter, there'd be the open skating at the arena and we'd all go down and skate circles around the ice for a while as a pastime. But that would have been it. And I never found myself ever thinking that I was good at it, and it bothered my ankles. So I never, especially because I didn't enjoy things that were cold, it's like, I need to find some activities I do in heated gymnasiums. And so
that can be tough growing up in Calgary.
Well, I grew up in North Bay, Ontario, which is even worse because it's even much colder weather.
Mm.
But yeah, so it's like, I tended to also too, because of, you know, we didn't have a ton of money growing up, that all of my school sports were my sports activities, because there's no way I would have been able to afford early on to be, you know, joining sports teams, and certainly not buying hockey equipment. You know, my one pair of quite probably purchased used ice skates that I had was enough. But, you know, being on the school track team, playing on the school volleyball team, it's like all you really needed was a pair of shoes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So pretty much all of my athletic endeavors were done through school, which would have been, you know, track and field, basketball, volleyball, stuff like that. And as an Northern Ontario student, unfortunately, we never had amateur wrestling, which I think I would have really enjoyed.
Mm.
So I, you know, played the sports that I had the chance to play in school, and that was pretty much my athletic endeavors.
And what age did you start playing on teams and competitively playing, you know, volleyball, track, basketball? Was this something that, well, I'm not going to play hockey, so I'm going to pivot very early on in my career? Or was this something you finally decided to take up when you were in high school?
Oh, no, I was, you know, way back in grade school. Like, I remember there being, you know, that we'd do track and field and stuff, probably just in gym class. I don't remember actual big meets or stuff in, like, you know, like grade 5 and grade 6. And I remember that in grade school, we did have like one men's and one girls volleyball, well, men's and women's, I suppose I should be boys and girls, be consistent. You know, there'd be a boys volleyball team, but unless you were, you know, in grade 6, you wouldn't make it because, you know, the younger grades didn't. But I remember playing on it a couple of years. So while being in a lower grade, managed to make these teams. And this would be, you know, 10 years old, 11 years old. And I think the thing that first made me competitive, though, we had a thing up here called the Canada Fitness Test, I think. It's part of the Canada Fitness Guide.
Hmm.
And it was a big participation thing that started to get, you know, kids more active. And there was a booklet, and we did it all in school. And it would have been, you know, I think as young as grade 4, maybe even younger. And there were all of these different events. There was a standing broad jump. There was a, probably for that age, a, you know, 40 meters or a 50 meter run. And there was flexibility. But there was
sit and reach test. We still have that. I'm a PE and health teacher.
Yeah, there was a flexed arm hang.
Yeah.
There was a shuttle run. But there was, you know, 10, 20, I don't remember how many different events. And for your age, there was a standard that you were to get to. And if you scored high enough in all of the different degrees, you could get a bronze, silver, gold, or the, you know, excellence award, which is even better than gold. And I remember taking whatever my first year was, I was clearly far enough ahead to be excellence in everything except the flexibility of sitting on the floor and touching your toes. So the first year I only got gold, and it really pissed me off.
Yeah.
So it's like the whole next year, I'm like, I got to work on my flexibility. I need some hamstring stretch here. And so the following year I got these, you know, the, and they give you one of those patches, like, you know, you'd sew on your sweatshirt if you were a real geek and wanted to have your athletic awards on your sweatshirt. So the following year I got excellence, and then that sort of parlayed into, you know, grade six, where I could play on the school basketball team, the school volleyball team. And then by grade seven, that's when you actually had, you know, city meets and stuff, and you'd, you know, have to make the track team and the volleyball team and the basketball team in junior high. And I was doing all of those, unless sometimes there'd be two sports at the same time you'd have to pick. Hmm. But in
was that the case with volleyball and basketball? Because I know, yes, up here, yeah, okay, so they're both winter sports. Okay. So was, yeah, that, well, that was when you veered towards volleyball, I'm guessing.
Well, the real focus actually with volleyball was high school. Okay. And it was, volleyball was the same time as football. And that was a big thing, because we went to a football school and I was a big dude. And there was always that assumption, and well, you can play football, right? You can play football, right? And I decided to, everyone's telling me to do something, I'm doing the other.
Hmm.
And I went and played volleyball and really fell in love with it then. And basketball was the following season, because again, football and volleyball was in the fall, basketball and something else was in the winter. So the first year I played volleyball and basketball and then did track. But my second year of high school, there was a city team, which was a step up from the, you know, just the high school teams,
yep, like
that followed, yeah, the regular season. So I played high school volleyball, and then I had to decide, do I play high school basketball or do I play city league volleyball? And I made the call to go exclusively volleyball.
Hmm.
So then for, like, I had 5 years of high school because we had 9 through 13. That was the last year that they had grade 13. So I played both in grade 9. And
you're like, great, great. Last year they get rid of grade 13 is my last year. You're like, another year of school. That's a high school kid wants.
I liked school because I was playing ball and I enjoyed it. But it was... You could graduate after grade 12 if you're going to college or if you're just going to go get a job and be a high school graduate. But you needed grade 13 for university.
Okay.
So if you wanted to go to a, you know, higher end secondary education, you needed grade 13. So grade 10, 11, and 12, I played either the city league or actually on a provincial league at one point. But my last year of high school, which was grade 13, there wasn't that other year. That other season of volleyball to play. So I decided I'm going to have a go at basketball again. And this is where my competitiveness comes in, because the coaches were like, you haven't played basketball since grade 9. It's like, you think you can make the team? And I remember there was a dude, Dan Robarts was his name, who had played basketball all the time, but he had a large gut. He had turned into a bit of a beer drinker by the end of his high school days. And I remember when the coach told me that, I pointed at Dan and said, I'm taking his spot, because I can work harder than him.
Yeah.
And I made the team, and we were at the start of the season, he would play, say, you know, 70%. I would play 30%. But by the end of the season, it was the other way around.
Hmm.
And I remember my coach was like, well, you told me you were going to do it. I'm like, damn right I was. And I've always sort of been that competitiveness in me. And yeah. I was, you know, I didn't have the skills they had, but I had the conditioning and the drive that I was just a rebounding machine. And on offense, you know, basically just set picks so other guys could score, because my shooting was not particularly good after never doing it.
You did the dirty work. So.
But yeah, I could muscle in underneath and box guys out and get rebounds, because I was, you know, in the end of high school, I was like 210 pounds from, you know, weightlifting so much. Yeah. And I had the vertical, so I could physically push people around the paint a little bit.
Now, did you were you always gifted with a great vertical leap? Or, you know, I think that's something kind of like calf muscles, where, like, I don't think calf muscles, the size of them certainly doesn't relate to your vertical leap.
Better not for mine. I have no calves.
They're bigger than Jay's. They're bigger than Christian's. So.
Well, yes, but that's not saying much.
But, you know, I see, you know, I work with kids and I coach kids as well. And we do a lot of jumping and stuff in class and whatnot. Some kids are, and coordination certainly is, and agility certainly comes at different ages. But are you of the belief that, like, there's certain people that just have ridiculous hops? Or was that something that, you know, you were gifted with or in your genetics? Or you just, like everything else, you just worked your ass off to kind of be the best you could be in the best shape you could be?
I think, like most things when it comes to athletics, I do believe there's definitely a genetic component to it, you know, whether it be, you know, fast twitch, slow twitch, certain people have more explosion, but but within that, I think there's a genetic range. And obviously if you have both the genetic gift and you push yourself, then you reach even higher heights. But I do think, like, I've worked with some people and it's like, they seem to be doing it right, but it's like, they just don't come off the ground. Like, I do think there is something to that explosiveness. And I've always been, because my memory's not good enough, I don't know if it's chicken or egg, but it's like, I feel like it could always jump. But the fact that I was always jumping is why probably I got good at it.
Yeah.
And I remember one of the, I don't know how early we used to do it, but probably one of the things that really helped me the most is my buddy and I, Mike Higgins from North Bay, Ontario. If you're listening, Mike, hey, buddy. he and I spent a lot of time together. We'd, had a basketball. We'd go shoot hoops at the school or whatever. And to change up our game, we used to play 21, but we'd play alley-oop 21, where you couldn't touch the ground and the ball at the same time. So you would have to leap, catch his rebound, and shoot before you hit the ground. And we played this for years, and just the conditioning and training for your jumping and trying to maintain hang time and so forth, that, again, maybe I had the ability, so the game was doable, or whether playing it so many years really just worked on my vertical leap, that I just always felt like I was always jumping. You know, if I had to go upstairs, well, if I could jump them three at a time, why not just jump them three at a time? And even, God, I just remembered this now. My very first job, and I would have been probably like 13, 14. I worked as a farmhand for a guy. He was doing, you know, haying, which is a horrible, horrible, terrible job.
Yeah, baling hay, yeah.
Baling hay. It's like, man, that shit's picky. But after I did the haying for him this season, I just worked as a general farmhand. And he always had, you know, the trailer or whatever that you stack the bales of hay on that was, you know, 4 feet off the ground or whatever. And he was always amazed that it's like, I would always jump up and jump down off of it. And it's like, you know, where others would sort of, you know, hoist their way up and climb or try to step up and step down. And it's like, I just always jumped. And I've always had that ability. And again, I don't have the ups that I used to, but they're probably still above average.
Yeah. Have you played like after all the years of wrestling, have you shot any hoops recently or in the last 10 years? You still play when things are safe and proper to play?
God, I haven't in forever. Although volleyball, and it killed me after I, again, retired, so to speak, I would have still, you know, I had my school.
Sure.
I guess I would have had the school. But my daughter would have been in grade school, junior high, maybe. I think grade school. And her teachers had a weekend volleyball tournament. And they were short a man, and they were looking for someone. And parents of students were eligible. And I'm like, oh, man, I haven't played volleyball in forever. I'll go play. And I hadn't played volleyball in a long time. And certainly, well, I guess I played at 210, 215 pounds, but never at, you know, 2 1/4. But I went, and since I only know one speed, I played like 14 games in one day.
Oh, man. Oh, no.
Full out. And I kid you not, I could not walk the next day.
Yeah.
My knees were destroyed. And actually, after that, I actually had to go get my knees checked. And that's what led to my needing to get the only surgery I've ever had. And it was just meniscus tears.
Oh, okay.
And looking back, I think what happened was when I played volleyball back in the day, I got very good at absorbing the landing and landing soft. But 15, maybe 20 years of pro wrestling at that point in time, where you constantly punch your feet on landing to make impact sounds that you do in a ring that has give and padding.
Yeah.
I think I was landing stiff-legged and punching my landings on the hardwood floor.
Wow.
After every time I, you know, spiked the ball or, you know, blocked the ball, that just that pounding on a hardwood floor just destroyed my knees. Oh, I was hurting for so long after that.
Oh, and, yeah.
And that was the last time I ever played volleyball.
Yeah, it sounds very... Yeah, it's like when you first learn to hit the ropes and you feel like you broke your rib the next day, your right rib. It probably had that through your whole body, I'm guessing.
Well, you can imagine, you know, if you've ever taken, you know, if you've ever taken, of course you've taken it. But, you know, the reverse atomic drop, the front ass bump or sure. whatever. But it's sure. like you go way up. When you come down, you punch with your legs hard to make that impact sound rather than trying to land soft. And it's like, I think I landed like that every game for 14 games on a hardwood floor in one day. And it was just like, oh my God.
You know, it's funny you mention that because I remember I used to, my grandmother's yard had a ton of apple trees and I loved to climb them when I was a kid. And I remember like I would jump from like 8 feet down, like 9 feet down as like a 5-year-old, 6-year-old. And then when you go there and things are much smaller and, you know, you're an adult and you're like, oh my God, how, like you go and you try to climb up and you hang and it's like you fall. You're like, I don't want to let go. I don't want to land. Savage, like anyone coming, like I'd rather, I don't do dives aside from a plancha over the, or just the house show dive, whatever, you know, over the top rope. But I would rather do any kind of dive with someone that's going to catch me than come off the top rope with an axe handle
land on your feet.
The knees and the, oh. And I always would twist my ankles. I was always getting sprained ankles when I would run. I'd always find a pothole. And, yeah, it's brutal. And I asked you that because I played basketball all through my childhood, all the way up through pretty much through college. Of course, once wrestling happens, you know, I think you said it before, your shoulders have taken a beating. My shoulders are, you know, there's arthritis in there. They're good. I do my DDPY and the rest of my body feels great, but those shoulders are the first thing to get sore. And when I would play basketball at school, when I was in a brick and mortar school, we'd play basketball a lot and the kids, I was like you, I was like, I'm going to play defense and I'm going to, I'm not shooting because I could barely get up a three because the arms were just, the shoulders were just so beat up. And,
My shoulders aren't too bad for that. But I know the last time I shot a basketball. Actually, there's a basketball hoop where my at a playground where my in-laws are, and I have gone there to just shoot hoops, do something while we're up at the cabin. But my issue is my right elbow. I hyperextended it in 2003-ish. There was that year where I wore the big, huge black leather hinged elbow brace when I was in WWE.
Yep.
I had my elbow hyperextended really bad. And if I shoot hoops for any length of time, I find I pop that elbow. That just on the release, my elbow going completely straight aggravates it. And that's something that it's the curse of being in wrestling so long is there's all these little things that, oh, geez, that doesn't feel right. Where if I just go about my normal life, for the most part, I feel good and not much bothers me. But if you push something and do something unique, then you realize that, oh, that elbow's a little bit off, or that ankle's a little bit off. And it's that's just the, you're never 100% when it's all said and done.
Right. Yeah. You don't have to take any threes when you can just dunk it, which I'm sure you've done. Last thing here on basketball with your hops, and especially when you were playing basketball, I'm guessing you were able to dunk, correct? I mean, yes. You're 6 feet, so.
Yeah, I'm a smidgen under 6 feet, although I could only dunk if I was alley-ooped to.
Whoa.
Because
of that game, probably because of the game you were playing with Mike Higgins.
Well, no, it was that as a volleyball player, which was my predominant thing, it's like I use my arms so much in my leap that I can't be hanging onto the ball and jump that high.
Mm.
I need my arms for that standard approach that you do in volleyball, that where the extra oomph gets there. Mm. So if I'm hanging on to the ball, I didn't have the ability to jump high enough to dunk. But if I could jump on my own merit on my own and a guy threw the ball to me, I could catch it in the air and dunk. Wow. But yeah, it was just the way I had always done my jumping. I can't carry the damn ball while I jump.
I can't palm it either. So I don't
know. I've got stubby little short fingers. I can't palm a basketball. I can barely do a volleyball.
Hey, I want to ask you about your diet and workouts over the years. You were always in phenomenal shape, but I remember you telling us in OVW how, you obviously love Cracker Barrel, and when you'd be on the road, you'd always you'd get your protein, you'd get your healthy carbs. I'm guessing dry with no butter. but you always, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but you said how you limited your fats. And there's a lot of, we've learned more about the keto diet and healthy fats now. And I don't do the bodybuilding work. It's long gone since I've done the quote unquote bodybuilding workouts that we all used to do, or eating every 2 hours. But how, going back to when, you got into wrestling and, you've evolved and adapted over the years. How has your diet changed since, when you were in what you felt was your best shape of your life to now that you're not an active worker anymore?
Yeah. Nor in the best shape of my life.
Yeah.
I'm doing okay for my age, but I'm not in the best shape of my life.
Yeah.
But it's funny that, like, I was never the meal prep guy that's, prepping everything and counting how many grams of this or grams of that. I was lucky in that even as a kid, I always had a good diet. Again, part of it was just that, with limited funds, we ate what we had to, but we never ate a lot of junk food and so forth. But up until, I'm guessing 25, might have been 24, but somewhere around there. Up until then, I could eat whatever the hell I wanted. It didn't matter. I was one of those lucky guys that could, eat a whole cheesecake. But since I was so active and, weightlifting since I was 12, this Christmas will be 40 years of weightlifting for me.
Wow.
Yeah. So I always had, I had good genetics. My dad was a weightlifter and had a good build. So I always had a good build and I could eat what I wanted. So I never had to watch my diet. But when 25-ish, might have been 24, hit.
When you got to Smoky Mountain.
It was still good in Smoky Mountain. Actually, Smoky Mountain would have been 25, so maybe it was, in my mind, it was in Japan, so maybe it was 26.
Okay.
But where I had to, the metabolism started to slow down, and I'm like, oh, geez, maybe I'm going to have to do something here. And at that time, the big thing was, you reduce your fat, you cut your fats out. And I'm like, all right, I'm an all or nothing person.
Yeah.
So it was pretty much, again, I was a, drink a quart of, 2% milk every single day type of guy. So it's like I switched to skim milk, and it's like I was a big, you know, toast with butter and peanut butter on it every day. And I'm like, well, I'm going to stop eating butter. I'm going to stop eating peanut butter. And I basically just cut out all of those things, like 100%. Like I just stopped and went a decade without ever eating peanut butter. And I wouldn't eat desserts, like no cookies, no cakes. It, you know, my wife would, once I was with her, she would make like a fruit crisp or cobbler or something, if you will. Sure. If it was like for my birthday or something, because I wouldn't even eat cake on my birthday. I don't eat junk food.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
No more donuts, no more cookies, no more chips. And I just stopped all of that. And it was just a case of, in my mind, it was, I'm eating for a purpose, not for enjoyment.
Yeah.
And I just stuck to that, because as someone who refused to go the extra miles on the, you know, the drugs that can help you in the dietary front, as well as the bodybuilding front, I had to work twice as hard without. So it's like, I can't afford to cheat on the diet. And, you know, those who are like, man, how are you so strict? I'm like, I wear spandex on television, dude. It's it's a hell of a motivator. Here's a pair of Speedos. Go on national television.
Try having a heartthrob gimmick where you have to look like a fitness model in your first intro into national worldwide television. So it was, I totally get it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great gimmick if you can, but it's a tough gimmick to keep oh, I've got an 8-pack. It's like, well, you got your work cut out for you now, dude.
If you want to work into your 40s, then it's, you might want to gimmick, evolve or gimmick change.
Yes. You might want a different gimmick.
Yeah. So what, when you came to OVW and you weren't actively working anymore, how did your diet change? How did your workouts change? I know you now. Are you a big proponent of machines versus weights? Because I remember you said your shoulders, you used to do machines because your shoulders, I think, were at the time were sore from just from the wear and tear of wrestling.
Yeah, when I first started working out, I was way more of a free weight guy. But by OVW, I was getting to be a big fan of the hammer strength machines and using cables and Smith machines and so forth. Because, you know, 40 years now of weightlifting is hard enough on your shoulders, let alone the 30 years of pro wrestling. So I did start getting to the point where, you know, I much preferred machines, which is killing me now because I can't go to a gym, and I've got a set of power block dumbbells and a adjustable incline bench here at home. So I can get some workouts in, and I was doing well with it for the, you know, the first half of the year or more I've been spending at home lately, but it gets very redundant, and constantly doing the dumbbells and so forth, my shoulders do at times ache and makes it hard. So my workouts currently are not that great. And to be honest, before this, it was Bill DeMott was the one that first sort of coined the term. I saw someone ask him on a social media platform, you know, what's your split or what's your schedule for working out? And he says, I work out whatever part hurts less.
Yeah.
And there is, again, I'm not that bad, but there are times where when you have a full gym and a full option, it's like, if I'm feeling like my shoulders are hurting a bit today, it's like, okay, I'll go do other things.
Yeah.
And the days that you're feeling frisky and things are feeling good, it's like, hey, you know what? I'm going to, you know, get heavy with the dumbbells here and do some presses and see what I can do. But now that I've been home for, you know, 14 months or whatever it's been, and you only have really, you know, a couple of options for every muscle part. And really, I'd kill to have a lat pull down machine. I'm telling you,
they have if. On Instagram, I see the, you know, you'll see I don't go on Instagram a lot, but when you do, you'll get certain ads and stuff. And there's like some home pulley device that where you hook it up to I think a pull-up bar, and there are devices for home lat pull down and home cable exercise systems. So I never tried them, but you look into that, because I know that there are like pulley and lever systems that kind of
this is where hindsight would have been great, in that if I had known 13 months ago that we were still going to be here months.
Yeah.
Because I've got enough space in my basement. My one, my only daughter that's still living at home, she works out too. It's like, I'd have gotten a full cable system downstairs for the basement. But it kept thinking, it's like, I'll be in a couple months. And it's like, you know, it's like, you're, you know, we've got enough. We can get by for the time being. And it's like, you keep putting it off and putting it off. And it's like, now that it's been a year, I'm like, I should have just bought that big cable system to fit down here. But now I'm to the point where it's like, well, surely we've, that's the light at the end of the tunnel there. It's like, I'll just be able to go back to the gym again. So I should have just sucked it up the very first time and put in the full cable system in the basement. And I'd have been happy.
Hey, have you, you know, as you, you know, as you got older, do you, and you have limited, you know, especially the last 15 months, you have limited resources. Have you got into biking or hiking or, you know, any outdoors activities that, obviously not in the winter, but,
Hiking for sure. I did a lot of that last year, and I'm hoping to do a way more this year. A former student of mine, Chris Knight, who I became really good friends with, he actually was an assistant coach for me the last few years with Storm Wrestling Academy. He was big into hiking, and I kept seeing the photos he's posting. I'm like, God, it's like, because I'm, you know, we've got the Rocky Mountains right near us.
Yeah.
So the last summer, we did a few hikes and did some mountain climbing. And not mountain climbing where you're climbing up the side of the mountain. Mountains that have trails and pathways up them with, you know, some sections where you have to scramble hands and feet, but nothing that you actually need, you know, ropes and pulley systems for or anything.
Right.
And so I did a few of those, and I posted photos online. You know, Devil's Thumb in Lake Louise was incredible. It was just the most amazing, you know, about a little over 2 hours to get up it, and then another two to get down. But it was just amazing. And then we did Table Mountain in Kananaskis. And then actually my massage therapist, she hikes a bit. And I couldn't get Niter to go with me the one day, and she was available. So her and I went and hiked Moose Mountain, which was another one. So I've got the All Trails app for all the cool hiking trails in Alberta. Yeah. And I've already highlighted about about 8 or 10 I want to do this summer. So I'm hoping to do that. Cycling is the one thing I'm not, well, not the one thing. It's one of the things I'm not supposed to do.
Okay.
In that I do have some minor neck issues.
Sure.
And I had some, you know, surprise, surprise, some neck compression after 30 years of wrestling. And I do traction on my neck occasionally. But the one position that the doctor told me to avoid, because it puts the most impingement on the one nerve in my neck that is affected by the compression, is tipping my head up.
Yeah.
And most cycling you do, you're leaning forward and you tip your head up to see the road.
Yeah.
And doing that for long periods of time, he says, you know, cycling is probably not a good idea. And he says, to be perfectly honest, neither is swimming, because you tend to have your chin all the way up for far too long at a time. And if I do that for long periods of time, if the impingement gets to the point where I'll get a little bit of a headache.
Yeah.
And slight dizziness. And as long as I make sure that I keep my posture straight and my chin tucked rather than up, I don't have any issues.
Yeah.
So I avoid cycling, but it's tough. Hiking it.
Cycling's tough. I sold my street bike because riding on the road kind of freaked me out. So we got, my wife and I both have mountain bikes. And yeah, it does, it, you know, when I had my street bike, I would go on a couple 45 and 50 mile rides, and you're beat up. I was feeling like you after the next day. I, like when you played volleyball, it does. And definitely you're not in that, your neck isn't in that neutral position the whole time. So, I can totally relate to that.
And then the other thing I did last summer too, which was just a weird thing that came of it. There's, a guy, I retweet him a lot on Twitter. What's his actual name? Riccone something is the – Ricky Smith is his name. But he does a Rake Now, a Random Act of Kindness Everywhere charity. I met him when I agented the Wrestling Retribution Project in L.A., that Jeff Katz project that fell apart and never happened.
Yeah.
He was there. And he, for some reason, was doing a thing, and he talked about how he wanted to see if he could cycle 50 miles in a day. And so I was following him and talking to him online and stuff when he managed to, on his bike, cycle 50 miles. And he sort of did, oh, you should try it. And I'm like, I can't cycle that much. And it's like, I thought about it. I'm like, all right, he cycled 50 miles. I wonder if I could walk 25 miles in a day.
Hmm.
So I decided I was going to. And it's like I had to pick a day. And I went online and used Google Earth to sort of map out, okay, where exactly in town would I have to walk to cover 25 miles? And I did it in two stints in one day. I stopped and had lunch and, you know, changed my socks. But I did do, I did 20 miles the first outing and then finished up with another five. And then still had to walk my dogs afterwards. So I ended up doing 28 miles in one day.
Wow.
Just walking. Yeah. Wow. I've always loved walking. And part of me wants to, because I made it to 28.
So that's a part good of me wants six to, or 7 hours of walking.
Yeah, it was the 25 was just under 7 hours. To get to the 28, I broke 7 hours. So yeah, it's a long time. I just loaded up the monster playlist on my phone and I just went and hoofed it by myself.
And there's like 14,000 hours of audio on this site. So
yeah, there's no shortage of audio. That's for sure. But yeah, I think I actually did. I like purposefully went a couple days without listening to my regular podcast. I'm like, all right, I got four podcasts from the Observer site. I got a 7 hour playlist of music. I should be good to go. But part of me this summer or this spring, when it's not too hot, part of me wants to just beat it and do a full 30 miles.
Wow.
And I'm a Fitbit step tracker as well.
Hmm.
And I think it was like 56,000 steps that day. Wow. So I think if I push to 30 miles, I might break the 60,000 steps in a day. And I like setting records. So, and I'm not going to be able to set speed or strength records anymore. So just sheer stubborn will and endurance ones I can still manage.
Yeah, you'll feel better than the day after volleyball. You'll be sore, but I think you won't be doing any landings. So
yeah,
repeatedly.
Yeah.
So
I was sore. Actually, with the hiking, I found the hiking poles are awesome.
Okay, I have a friend who's hiking the Appalachian Trail right now. He's in Tennessee, and he on Instagram. If you go to @WhaleVereen, whale like whale Vereen. He's a nut. He's a guy I know. I used to work at the old school I used to work at. He was an interventionist. And he quit the job there and went and had some money saved up and is hiking the Appalachian Trail. And he has the poles, and he's like, these things have saved me on numerous occasions so far. And he goes, I don't know how people can hike without these now that I've done it.
Yeah, it's nice to use your arms and move your arms more. It keeps your hands from swelling. But the big difference for me doing when I did Devil's Thumb without them, that coming down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That breaking with your knee, you know, having to slow yourself down so you don't, you know, topple and come stumbling down. It is a lot on your knees. And having those poles, and I've got good ones that have this slight, you know, spring in them with a little bit of shock absorption in them. That you can lengthen, they're adjustable too. So on the way up, you shorten them so they can be ahead of you going up. But on the way down, you can lengthen them, and you can use those to slow yourself down so the impact's not in your knees. And it was just a lifesaver. So when I did Table Mountain, I took the poles, and I'm like, wow, what a difference.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm definitely going to use those more and more this year with my hiking.
Yeah, coming down, you can do a lot of sliding. I've never used the poles, but I know coming down, it's pretty risky once you start sliding a little and you're like, oh. So hey, I want to finish up here with some wrestling talk, but I don't want to talk about, you know, I don't want to talk about shows or ratings. That's for other shows here. I want to talk about some training and having trained under you and later on after WWE, having trained others myself, I wanted to ask you so I used to do all the Dr. Tom camps when he first started doing them in 2002, 2003, and you know, I got signed in 04. So I would do all the Dr. Tom camps when he'd come around to the area. And Ivar, who's one of the Viking Raiders now, he was used to be known as Handsome Johnny from up here in New England. And he would do all the camps as well. And Dr. Tom gave us, he had like three pages of the man in the middle drill, different spots, you know, tackle, drop down, hip toss, whatever. And we would use that, you know, after WWE and then for ourselves, we would use that as kind of a training template and curriculum, I guess. When before you got to OVW and when you knew you were going to be the head trainer there, how did you go about making a curriculum or coming about a template for what drills you wanted to do and how you wanted to, you know, just kind of coming up with a, I don't want to say a workbook or a handbook, but a, just a general idea of the training
game plan,
a plan for what you wanted to do.
You know, it was funny cause I really winged it. I really did. Okay. Like I had run, the Heart camp in 91 and 92, but that was taking people from scratch, right? We all teach them to bump. I'll teach them to do this. Where OVW, I really had no idea what to expect because I had no idea what stage anyone was at.
Yeah, and let me, not to interrupt, but let me preface this by, you had guys like Nova who had been working for 15 years at the time and who could train people himself, was the most experienced guy there. You had, and then you had guys like Nick Nemeth and Bobby who were just starting. And then you had people like myself, people like Mickey, people that had been on the independents and were already solid workers, but you had to polish up and get ready, get us ready for what they wanted at the next level.
Yeah, and that was sort of the weird thing, because Nick Nemeth, Dolph Ziggler, they hired him after I was already there. Because he was, right when I got there, I was the, hey, we're looking at this kid, train him, you know, as part of the class for the next couple of weeks, and then let us know what you think. So he wasn't even, you know, signed yet when I got there. So yeah, there was guys that were, you know, starting from scratch, and that's where, that was the hard part, because it's like you've got your one class and it's like, okay, I got to take, you know, Nick and Bobby and try to get them so that they can participate in what we're doing with everybody else. And like you say, you know, there was Mercury wasn't signed, but Joey Mercury was there. John Morrison was there, who was pretty good at that point. Jeter. And, you know, there was guys that were quite good.
Mondo.
Yes. Mondo, I love Mondo. He was crazy.
Everyone does.
But yeah. Mondo was like, at that point in time, was like the most useful guy there because he was like that utility guy that could do anything you needed him
and
to.
And he did I remember he did, we would go to class at 12. He had the 10 o'clock class and I would go to that class with Roselli and like Mondo was teaching that class and you had like Elijah, you had all like the non-contract people there. I think Beth was in that class at one point, Beth Phoenix. So yeah, Mondo, underrated just in every aspect of the business. Yeah.
He was the guy, I think every promotion, every wrestling school that can afford to have an assistant needs a guy like Mondo. That's just, no matter what you need, like, you know, you go to a live event, it's like, you need a heel, Mondo can do it. You need a babyface, Mondo can do it. You need a comedy match, Mondo can do it. Like, he could do anything.
Yeah.
And I loved Mondo. And also too, he's entertaining as hell to ribs. So it really was just a fly by the seat of my pants and so, okay, see where these guys are. And I think, you know, I think Danny gave me we usually start our, you know, our sessions out this way with a little bit of a, you know, a warm up and a couple things. I'm like, okay, great. I'll start with that. And then it was just more a case of, you know, those first couple of days, I just bluffed my way through to keep guys busy. And it was just trying to figure out, okay, where is everybody? And because I was literally coming right down from the main roster and had been working with some of the actual development guys when they, you know, they'd get brought up to do a loop of house shows, I was often the guy that working with them on those house shows with, you know, hey, take these guys and, you know, teach them some stuff and show them the ropes. And
I,
you know,
I remember I went to a house show. I think it was February of 2002, right before Lesnar came up. It was a Saturday night house show. You, Springfield, Mass. You worked with Brock Lesnar on that show. And I, you know, I remember hearing things about him and you know, Minnesota Stretching Crew and whatnot. And yeah, you were, yeah.
Yeah, was... I did three shows that loop with Brock, and it was a case of just the, you know, we obviously see a lot in this guy. It's like, you know, go out there and push him a bit and make him work and, you know, help him along. And yeah. Brock had an amazing learning curve because, again, we went up first night and I'm like, all right, you're a little bit too much of this, too much of that, whatever. You know, gave him three or four things that I thought, you know, he could, you know, either tone down or tone up. And then, like, the next night, it's like every one of them was exactly what I asked him to do and fix. And I'm just like, damn. So it's like, gave him a few more things. And the next night, it's like, fixed again. I'm like, damn, this guy's good. Yeah. And it was also, it's a funny story. it pissed me off bad. But again, it was first one. It's like, you know, take him out there, get, you know, go 15 minutes or whatever and, you know, cheat to beat him. Make sure you keep, you know, make him still look strong. So I'm like, okay, so we did a bunch of near falls and I cheated somehow to beat him. I don't remember how. And then the next night, same thing. And then the third night, wherever it was, Jack Lanz was the agent. He comes over. He's like, we'd like Brock over tonight. I'm like, okay. And we went out and did our 15-minute match and back and forth near falls and stuff and put Brock over clean. And I came back and Lanz come up and he's like, you know, all that back and forth stuff you guys are doing, you know, it makes for a good match and all, but we're looking to program him a certain way and we want him to look strong. And I don't remember. I know I said something to Jack. I thought a lot more than what I said, but it was, you know, something to the effect of, it's like, well, you know, it's like, I'll do whatever you want, but you got to let me know before you go out. It's like, yeah, you had me beat him the first two nights in competitive matches. And now you're telling me that I'm supposed to get squashed.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, you know, we were trying to program a certain way. And I think I just got mad and walked away with a, I'll do what you want, but you got to tell me ahead of time, Jack. This is bullshit.
Yeah.
And it was getting to the point, too, where I was getting ready to look about getting off the roster and doing something else because of stuff like this.
Mm.
And it's like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize I wasn't supposed to have a good match. But I'd worked with him. I worked with Nick Dinsmore. And I know several people credit me with getting him called up in that I did the house show loop with Nick. Nick was really good.
Yeah.
And we had a couple really good matches. And I remember Benoit pulling me aside after the first one on the house show. And he's like, man, that's like one of the best stories in a match I've seen here in years. Like, that was just awesome. Mm. And I was the babyface actually. And you know, we worked my arm in the heat and tied everything into the arm. And it was really great. And we got to TV and they had me work Nick again on Sunday Night Heat, although they put Nick under the Conquistador mask.
Okay.
And we did this pretty much the same match again, although they edited like half of it off television. And that was the week or the following week that they, you know, gave him the call and said they're going to bring him up.
Mm.
And it was also the week that I talked with Jim Ross and negotiated the trainer's gig.
Okay.
Because the following week, Benoit comes up and he's like, oh, man, you got Nick hired. You got him a spot. I just looked at him and said, yeah, I got him mine. And he's like, what? I said, yeah, I gave my notice. I'm done on the roster now. Yeah. And he was like, oh, my God. And then I went to OVW to train.
Yeah.
So, again, I, you know, once I sort of saw different things that were missing, if you will, from what I knew they wanted for people on TV, then I would, you know, that night in my hotel room going, okay, you know, these guys aren't aggressive enough. What can I do to make them more aggressive? And I would just invent a drill. And then if we were doing something else that I'm like, okay, you know, they seem to be, you know, their selling's a bit off. So, all right, we got to do some kind of drill where we can work on their selling.
Yeah.
Because I don't like it. It's fine if it's just a training camp, but when it's like, you're specifically getting people ready for something.
Yeah,
I find just generic drills, people get just too comfortable and too routine with them.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, again, the Les Thatcher triple five. Like, it's a great conditioning thing, and it's a good warm-up to start your day. I've pinched that a million times.
Yeah.
But when you've already been signed and it's like we're trying to get you ready for TV, it's like, other than just some conditioning, it's like, that's not going to get you anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because I love that drill personally. I used to effing hate it. Dr. Tom would start it off every camp, and nobody ever wanted to go in and start it. And I've done camps with Les, and I've had Les into when I had a school or a ring to come in. I like that, but I like it when, and Tom and Les liked it as well, when you turned it into a match, when you just didn't do it as a drill for the sake of doing a drill. But I don't remember ever doing that one in OVW, but I do. You mentioned how you would go back to the your room and formulate drills. You had one. It was a tackle drill. I think you set a timer for 30 seconds. It was like a tackle pin drill.
Oh, the tackle cover. Yeah.
It was tackle. I remember fucking Morrison was always, he'd always get him or Doan would always get more than everybody, but it was, I think it was tackle pin, hit the ropes. It was,
you'd send the guy off. He'd give you a tackle and cover you. And then you'd kick out. And as you kick out, as you get up, he sends you off, you tackle him. So it's tackle, cover, tackle, cover, tackle, cover.
Okay.
And I'm trying to think. It eventually became, you had, you know, we did like 45 seconds and we did a minute. You'd go a minute straight and how many you can do. I know the first time I did it, I don't remember the number. We actually just did it timed. And I was just trying to come up with something that could be competitive and fun from a conditioning standpoint.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time because I too am competitive. And the first time we did it, you know, it's like, okay, start. And, you know, the guys would start, do it, and they all did it. And it's like, we're waiting. And we got to the end, and Molina was the only one that hadn't gone. And I'm just like, hop in here, girl. I'll do it with you. And I did it with Molina, and I think we ended up being second.
Wow.
But it was a case, too, that I showed people afterwards. And this is where it ended up being a good learning tool, too, in that too many of the guys, you know, when they got kicked out, they'd go flying, you know, yeah, 4 feet away, yeah, on the kick out. And then they'd have to take 3 steps closer and then they'd back the person off the ropes to whip them.
Yeah.
And it wasn't something I consciously planned ahead of time, but I've always been a conserve your motion, conserve your spacing.
Yeah.
So when she'd kick out, it's like I'd be right there. When I grabbed her, I'd just send her off. And it's like, our whips were shorter, our distance was closer, so yeah, those tackles are coming quicker, and we just did it faster than almost everybody else.
You were right in the middle of the ring where a babyface would pivot for a bump and feed almost, and you didn't have – yes, it was – and now that I remember it, that where that comes into play, the first thing that comes to mind where that comes into play in a match is when you do the you know, I arm drag you, you arm drag me, you leg sweep me, pin me, I leg sweep you. And especially for that arm drag where you're taking one, then you have to give one, anything like that, you need to get a quick, you need to have minimal, you need to, once you take that, once you land on that arm drag, you need to already be getting right back up in position to give one. And maybe you can think of other instances, but that was where the minimal footwork, it was just the most efficient way of working.
Yeah, and it really makes you pivot and know your positioning.
Yeah.
That if you can pivot and get there rather than, you know, standing up and taking steps. And that's where when I'm coaching, especially a lot of the virtual coaching that I'm doing now, is one of the things that's like, there isn't that conservation of movement, and there's a lot of wasted motion. And to me, especially when you really want things to happen and be sudden, it's like shortening that distance. And I always use the analogy, it's like if you watch tennis and they're rallying the ball back and forth, if both guys are at the baseline, it's fairly slow, thunk, thunk, thunk. But as soon as one guy goes to the net and halves that distance, it's like that match is so much more exciting, and you're, because the beats of the thunk, 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 yeah, it's so much faster. And that's where in wrestling, if you can, in those moments that you want that action to be crisp, don't go 20 feet away, go 10 feet away.
Yeah.
And things happen tighter, and just conserving that. And we got them. I'm trying to remember, we started, you know, we did like a minute, how many you can get. Then we did it to 90 seconds at one point, which was just an incredible blow yourself
yeah,
up.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to think. I think it was Jimmy Wang Yang and Tank.
Okay.
That set like the fastest all-time record that they were once I, you know, showed them the trick of, you know, just pivot and keep that distance tight. And, you know, Tank was a machine. And again, I'm pretty sure it was Tank. I know for a fact it was Jimmy Wang Yang because that guy was like Grease Lightning. And it's like those guys were just going and I'm at the watch and I'm like, holy shit. And it was like, man, they're moving. And again, it wasn't so much a technique drill. It was just a competitive way to make a little bit of conditioning fun, as well as forcing you to actually remember your spot and hit your stuff. But yeah, I use the tackle cover one here a lot when I was running my school just as a conditioning.
And we would we would look forward to that because it usually be, I think, at the end of – I remember it being a lot at the end of practice. And it's not like we did it all the time. But yeah, it was fun. It was competitive. It was a fun competition among the boys and girls, men and women, you know?
Yeah, and that was one, too, that – and I always enjoyed – I couldn't do it anymore, but when I was running my school, I still could – that – when I'd have a session of newbies that, you know, their conditioning and cardio wasn't good and you could tell that they were sucking wind through it.
Yeah.
And I remember the one time I got hot at them and I hopped in and I did 10 guys in a row.
Wow.
And it was like, it's like, you have to be able to go. And it's like, I'd get the first guy in. It's like, let's go. And we did our 10. I'm like, next guy, get in here. They'd roll in. And it's like, I'd do another 10.
Yeah.
And I did 10 guys doing the 10 tackle and covers. And it's like, then I point out, it's like, I'm 45 years old.
Yeah, that's
it's
yeah.
like, and I'm not trying to make it anymore. It's like, you have to be able to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, I think Al had one where you did a spot in the ring, you threw the guy outside the ring and you did a chase around, but it was, yeah, there's, that's the fun part of it is coming up with different drills, different ways to improve that translate to the ring. I used to have guys and girls do the 10 kicks to each, you know, 10 kicks to the second buckle, go to the next buckle. Then I'd have them work on their stomps, 10 stomps to the bottom buckle or to a punching bag. Cause they would think a stomp and a kick were the same. And it's like, no, they're completely different. And same thing with punches too. You don't see a lot of people, you don't see a lot of workers with really good working punches anymore. And, you know, Lawler might have one of the probably best pure still working today, like pure, pure.
Still got a better punch than anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, these are things that the kicks, the stomps, the punches, those are things you can do at home. You don't need anyone to do. So it was, and again, it takes a while being around people like you, like Les, Dr. Tom. It takes a while to, you know, to figure these things out. But you certainly, it gets expedited when you're around people like yourself and Tom and Les. I wanted to wrap up here with a couple of things, but before we go on, Jimmy Yang, I never worked with him in WWE. But we worked a bunch in All Japan. He was so smooth and so effortless. And when I remember we did a couple times, we would have an opening match and we would have a nice 8 to 10 minute fun match, you know, in Japan and kind of do, I don't want to say WWE style, but Jimmy was always like, we're going to do our thing, but we're going to give him a little something different. And it was so much fun. And I got to work with him. I got to work with Kaz Hayashi, Jamie Noble as well, all the Young Dragons, yeah, so smooth and underrated.
Yeah. I worked with him once in WCW and it was funny cause I had just gotten there and I obviously was getting that push right away. He was green as grass, but
he was like 19 then. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like he had just started and I didn't know it. And they're just like, oh, you're having a single match with Jimmy Yang. And I'm like, okay, great. So it's like, I'm putting this together, giving him a bunch of stuff. We're having this. And I didn't know it till afterwards. Cause I'm just like, hey, we're having this match. He's my baby face. I'm going to make him look good. And we had this match and everything else. And it was afterwards that he was just like, oh my God, that was just so amazing. And then I find out that, you know, he's only been on like TV for like 2 weeks before I got there. He was young as shit and most guys weren't giving him stuff, but it was just like, man, but he was good. We had a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I always picked up some great subtle things that aren't so subtle, you know, may not, to the casual fan, they might not notice or the reason why you do them, but there's some things I picked up from you that I always use till this day. One is when someone has me in a headlock and I shoot them off, I use both hands. And I remember you telling us that, especially if you're a guy that's, you know, around my, you know, 5'10", 5'11", 200 pounds, you know, you got to use every ounce of effort that you have to shoot someone off. And that's in, you know, from the headlock. Another one was fronting the buckle. It never dawned on me and probably others that some people would front a buckle, you know, and they'd get shot off the same way that they would, you know, take the buckle to their back. And you always you instilled in us when you give someone a front to the buckle, like Bret Hart used to do, shoot them and then shoot them back into your own corner where you shot them from. So they don't have an opportunity to pivot or turn. And it might be hard for the listener to kind of understand that, but
Because I don't remember the reverse part, although I've done it that way. But my big thing was release them much later so it's closer to the turnbuckle so they don't have that chance to pivot. Because if you, especially, you know, the guys that do the shitty lucha whips where they, you know, they send you and you've got 18 feet to run to get to the turnbuckle. And it's like every other time someone goes into these things, they turn and hit it with their back. Why does this guy just run chest first in?
Yeah.
And if you do the reverse where they're, you know, they don't have the same ability to do the same footwork or release them much closer to the buckle so that you haven't given them that opportunity to turn, just so there's a reason why they hit it different than normal.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you what, you know, watching, doing the SWA virtual Academy and watching whatever wrestling you watch on TV, what, you know, basics never change. Good storytelling, solid work never changes. That stands the test of time. But every, you know, wrestling evolves, everything evolves. Sometimes, certainly the way you train, you know, in anything, coaching, training, teaching, certainly the way you handle and you work with people is different as time goes on. But I see some things that, you know, I'll see, for instance, when somebody goes up, someone is selling in the ring, the baby face goes up for a cross body and the heel is in there staring or looking up at the person climb the rope for the cross body. And they know the cross body's coming up, but they don't creatively sell or use their, you know, put their hand to their face and use peripheral vision or the, you know, things like that as having going on 20 years now in wrestling, you certainly pick up on. What are some things you see today that in your sessions or on TV that you see people doing that, hey, this can be improved on, or, you know, whether it's efficient footwork or that cross body, what are some things you see today that, hey, I can fix that, that should get fixed, that can be made better?
The biggest thing that I see, and I see it in almost every match, and it's not a major thing, but it's bothering me. And when I point it out to people, they're like, oh man, that'd be so much better, is the industry seems to have gotten so comfortable with routine without realizing the purpose behind it, that in most matches now the bell rings and both guys just move to their right, slow and without purpose, and they circle with their backs almost touching the rope. And it's like, why are you moving? It's like you're not close enough to actually wrestle anybody.
There's no proximity. There's no proximity for something to happen. Yeah.
And that's where, if and it's like they circle because they think they're supposed to circle, rather than, again, the way I was taught, and again, hopefully if I went back and watched my matches, I did more often than not, was if the bell rings and you start coming together, and then you pivot to a side to circle looking for an angle of attack, but you do it close. Like in boxing, it's like once you're sort of in that, you know, just outside of that jab reach, it's like, okay, that's where I got to look for my opening. You don't do it from the other side of the ring. And it really reminded me just recently about ways of making yourself stand out. If you remember Sabu in ECW,
yeah,
that bell would ring and that sucker would like dive out at your fucking ankle.
Yeah.
And it's like, you wouldn't know it's coming. I remember the first time I worked him, he just dove at my ankle and it's like, I stepped out of the ring real quick so he didn't get it. And it was his way of telling the audience, you have to watch every second because I can strike from anywhere.
Yeah.
And you always had to pay attention in a Sabu match because shit could always happen.
Yeah.
But now the bell rings and it's like, it doesn't feel like the start of the race. It doesn't feel like the start of a fight. It's just, well, now no, we'll circle.
We're going to circle. I'm going to lock up. I'm going to take your arm. You're going
to,
and it's.
Nope. But even to the point where it's like, they will circle at, you know, 18 feet away or 20 feet away, depending on the size of the ring. And then they'll both stop and then they'll take like 10 steps each to get to the middle to tie up. And it's like, you could have just did that without the spinning around the ring three times.
Yeah.
Where if the bell rang and you came towards each other and then pivoted and, you know, we're looking and reaching and we'd have to pay attention. And I think it's just setting a mood of, okay, what's going to happen here? How are they going to engage?
Yeah.
Rather than just, and it's just the habit, and we all develop bad habits. And again, I'm quite sure you can find a match of mine where I did that same damn thing. But it's that, you know, the babyface's goal should be to take center ring and own it. And if, obviously, if Mark Henry is my heel, then he's going to walk out to the center of the ring and I'm going to, you know, circle the planet and look for my angle of attack. But just to make it feel like we're engaging for a reason rather than just we're moving because we feel like we're supposed to be moving.
Oh, and that's, and you mentioned it, the babyface holding their ground. That's another thing I remember is when, you know, baby, you lock up, babyface bring, you know, move back to the corner, heel is in the, you know, back to the corner, and the referee break, you know, referee comes in, clean break. When, and I believe you taught this to us, was use that, don't take 20 steps back, backpedal, you know, to the other side of the ring. Keep the ref, you know, does a clean break, but you're still at the furthest in the center of the ring, looking eager. You're ready to lock up and you are, you know, you're ready to go. You're ready to engage. And I see a lot of people, not so much on TV, but I'll see it where baby faces will just take 20 steps, like they'll rush to take 20 steps back to the other side of the ring. And it's like, I don't know. You can correct me if I'm wrong or if you think differently, but the babyface shouldn't really backpedal there. Like you said, they should stand their ground.
Yeah, that was something I got from Finley.
Yeah.
He was the, you have to give him a clean break, so you have to take a step back or two. But if you stay within striking distance, people have to pay attention and watch. And then the heel can, you know, get out of the corner because he doesn't want to be stuck there. But if you just back up 18 or 20 feet, it's like, well, I can pull out my phone now. You're 20 feet away.
Yeah.
And then the other two, and it's just that instinct that, again, I've drummed into my head even more so, that thought process of a babyface moves forward, a heel can move backwards. Because, again, a heel can retreat, but you don't want your babyface retreating.
Yeah.
And if you stay close, verbal interaction can occur, things can happen. But if you go too far away, then it's like, and actually on that front too, it's a Norman Smiley analogy that, you know, if you're in there with, especially if, you know, if you're working with a more inexperienced guy, or if you're the inexperienced guy, it's like, he says, sometimes if I need to spoon feed you in the ring, so to speak, he says, if you want to spoon feed someone, you have to be close to him to do it.
Yeah.
And if we're 6 feet away, I can talk to you if I need to. You know what I mean? You can read me. I can read you. But if we just back up 18 feet, it's like, oh, shit, I might as well write a letter and mail it now.
Yeah. And even, you know, on the indies, you can't be, like most of the referees don't, it seems like they don't know how to communicate. You'll get some really good ones, but you also, you know.
Yeah, on the lower end of the indies, the referee is the guy that wasn't good enough to get on the show.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, last thing here. This is a hard question, and there's probably not one person to answer it. And I ask this to every worker I have on. Best worker you've ever been in the ring with? And I know that's – I don't want to say it's a loaded question or – and maybe it's a couple guys. But, like, one guy that – one worker where you were – afterwards, you were like – holy shit, that's a whole other level, or that was quote unquote the night off, that was so smooth, that was, I didn't have to think, you know.
Well, I don't have to think for this answer at all. Fit Finley, above
okay
all else, he was a different kind of, just to me, the most talented man I was ever in the ring with. Just that it was, everything he did was exact and precise. There was just never a moment of hesitation, just on another level. And I know when he was agenting in WWE before he made that comeback in 06 or whenever hell it was.
He'd get in the ring with us before house shows.
But there was times, and I would always say, it's like, no, you don't understand, like, Fit's the best. And they're like, oh yeah, I understand, he's good, because I've seen him, you know, walking through spots with talent and stuff during the day. I'm like, no, you don't understand. It's like, Fit's the best.
Yeah.
And then when he made his comeback and people started working with him, they'd be like, Fitz are the best. I'm like, I told you. You have no idea. And, you know, it's a slightly different style to anyone else, but he's just amazing.
Yeah.
And there's no one I thought I was ever in the ring with that I thought was better than Fit. I have so much respect for Fit. And the fact that Fit also was always the industry and the business first. That it was just, he was so great. And I learned so much from him in 93 and 95 when I worked with him in Europe. He was just amazing. I keep hearing his dad had it on tape. And I did a championship match with Fit in 95 where they brought me back to do a championship match with Fit. And it was just incredible. And I loved it. And I didn't know it was recorded. I've heard his dad did record it, so Fit may have it on tape. I've always wanted to get a copy, but never managed to. But yeah, Fit was just the best. Loved Fit. And yeah, he's just an amazing, amazing man.
Yeah, go back. Anyone listening, go back, watch some of that old, watch anything with Fit, but watch some of that old World of Sport stuff. He had the valet there. He could just get heat and was just phenomenal. So, hey, Lance, where, you mention it every Friday, but, you know, let's do it again. Tell us about the SWA Virtual Academy sessions and where people can reach you on social media.
Yeah, I do virtual coaching via Zoom, primarily match breakdown and feedback. You send me a match of yours. I look at it, analyze it, break it down, make notes. The notes are extensive. I've shared them. There's an example pinned to my Twitter, which is actually one of the more simple versions I've said. I should probably post another one. But swavirtualtraining@gmail.com. If you're interested, email me there. I've done it with wrestling schools as a group. I've actually got another one coming up in a few days, as well as one-on-one. One-on-one sessions are $125 US or 3 for $300 if you want to book more than one session, a little bit cheaper. Again, I break down the match, write up all my notes, send that to you, and then we do a one-hour Zoom session where we watch the match back together and discuss all the notes and any questions you may have. And again, you can follow me on Twitter, @LanceStorm, and pinned to the top of my Twitter is all the details as well as an example of the notes for one of the match reviews that I had done.